Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
Yes, welcome to Tuesday afternoon's Kildare Focus. Owen with you until 3 o'clock this afternoon. We have plenty of chat and music coming up over the next hour or thereabouts. We'll start off with COVID-19 because it's making the headlines once again. The number of patients presenting at GP surgeries with COVID infections reported in the past few weeks. Does it add up to official figures? 64,000 COVID-19 diagnoses over the bank holiday weekend. Postmasters call for emergency meeting discussing potential industrial action. We'll talk to the Irish Postmasters Union. C-sections, we'll chat about this with Assistant Professor in Organisational Psychology at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Siobhan Corrigan. The fear of natural birth and negative experiences are pushing more women towards elective C-sections. And then Owen Corry will join us just before 3 o'clock as Shannon Airport is now scrapping the 100 milliliter liquid restriction for outbound passengers. We'll also talk about the travelling in and out of the country and around Europe. Has that been affected by what's going on in Ukraine? So that is the menu between now and 3 o'clock. As always, get your messages into us. We would love to hear from you on this Tuesday afternoon. You can WhatsApp or text 0833 97 97 97. You can email studio@kfmradio.com or indeed call us here on 045 898 999. Now, Dr. Brendan O'Shea is a Newbridge-based GP. He's also a spokesperson for the Kildare Faculty of the ICGP and Assistant Professor for Primary Care at Trinity College Dublin. Brendan, good afternoon to you and welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Owen.
As I mentioned there in the outset, 64,000 cases over the course of the bank holiday weekend. It's a rise that perhaps was expected. I know just on the Wednesday before the bank holiday, everyone was talking about this spike in cases, but cause for concern in your opinion?
Absolutely. This is our sixth or seventh surge. Before COVID was even mentioned, we know that there's always a surge in viral illnesses in the autumn and in the springtime. So this is the spring or the vernal surge. It's not all COVID. It's a fantastic mix of COVID-19. There's definitely some influenza in the neighbourhood. And then there's a host of other viral respiratory tract infections and some gastroenteritis. And so we're in the middle of it. And it's very difficult.
So, as I mentioned there, obviously, the COVID-19 cases, very, very high. I see immunologist Luke O'Neill saying that the new BA2 variant is sweeping up everyone who didn't get Omicron. Look, obviously, over the last number of weeks and months, we've seen the relaxation of restrictions, mask wearing, testing has been kind of eased out for certain age cohorts. Was that done too early, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think we've got to respond to the situation as it evolves. I think this is an inevitable consequence of every springtime. And I think, you know, there's a temptation to look for guidance from the powers on high. Really, as a society, we have done really well with this, and we should keep on doing the same things. I wouldn't be waiting for public health. I'm a GP. We're all on for personal health. Personal health. So do the simple things well, not wanting to sound like rugby. Put the masks back on, wear them more consistently, be aware of social distancing. Be particularly careful if you're clearly linked in with a medically vulnerable individual. That's either somebody who's older, somebody with complex medical conditions, or very small children. A really important thing, where we've done best of all, has been in our national rate of immunisation, but there is still 10 to 15% of the population who are slow, who either have not been immunised or who have not completed their immunisations. These people are really important. They're important because they're particularly taking up beds in ICU units around the country. They're particularly taking up capacity in hospitals, and they need to do that. But this could be avoided if they could get immunised. So can you have the conversations in your circle? So if you're sitting down with somebody, if you're on a Zoom, if you're at work, everybody asks, did you get immunised? Make it a topic of conversation. We've no time for hardship, punishing and floggings. But please, if anybody out there hasn't been immunised, can you get immunised? If you get COVID and the current variant is milder, you're far less likely to have your bacon in the backslicer. You're far less likely to end up in the ED of our fantastic local hospitals, and significantly less likely to be in an intensive care unit bed.
Okay, let's stay on that point then, Brendan, because the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation issued a release today, 660 on trolleys, and they say it's time for the Minister to declare a national emergency. The INMO General Secretary, Philney Hay, who herself is a NACE resident, said we've seen a 15% increase of patients on trolleys in the last 24 hours, with 660 patients for whom there are no beds. So this is not just a COVID issue. This is an overcrowding within the hospitals, but obviously it's been exacerbated by COVID-19.
Well, there are a couple of reasons why people are required to be in those beds, and they're not all good ones. And I don't want to go on about how little we've invested in Irish healthcare, because that's not true. We're spending a lot on healthcare in Ireland. We're spending at similar rates to most other affluent European societies. But in our communities, and certainly we see this in general practice, our older, frail patients have relatively little support compared to other health systems. We are not investing in primary care. We're 40% short of GPs compared to the NHS. We're even shorter when it comes to general practice nurses. The funding that we make available for social care, for carers, is significantly inadequate. So as long as you've got those weaknesses at the community level, our casualty departments are going to be flooded. And at least some of those cases, it's the right person in the wrong place at the wrong time. If we had better social support, if we had stronger primary care, almost certainly not as many people would require to be in the casualty departments. Hospitals are for carrying out acute and complicated medical tasks. They're not the right places to be providing social support and social care. More could be done, for example. We have 28,000 nursing home beds. We have 11,000 beds in the acute hospital sector. If we had more GP presence, more of these cases could be looked after in our nursing homes, which are fantastic. So Philney Hay is right to highlight this, but it's important that we don't jump to the wrong conclusion. And I'd go back. Let's go back to personal hygiene. Mm. What can the good listeners of KFM be doing? You can wear your mask. You can stay 1.5 metres. You can stay out of crowded areas. Encourage everybody to get immunised, please.
Just to finish up then on this point and come around full circle, you're talking there about the preventative measures that people can take, and you know, you don't want to flog a dead horse and talk about it over and over again, but it is people's personal responsibility. Some will say, yeah, you know, the mask wearing, it's done, over and done with. When I go into a shop, I don't wear it, some may say. Others then will say, I wouldn't go into a shop now without the mask, and that's fine. The testing though, Brendan, you know, we heard 64,000 cases over the weekend. The fact that the testing has been scaled back significantly for particular cohorts, are we missing a lot of COVID-19 diagnoses?
No, we're not. I had the pleasure of being on duty on KDOC on St. Patrick's Day with the KDOC team and did my 6 hours. We were dealing with very large numbers of people. There's a staggering amount of testing going on. People are being brilliant around rapid antigen testing. They're shelling out. They're getting their tests done. They're getting their tests done at day one, day three, and day five. And we're having very informed conversations with them. So creating more PCR testing isn't actually going to push down the numbers quickly. What will flatten this curve, and that we're back in that game again, is not what the Minister for Health is going to say. It's what we all do. So it's dull, it's boring, it's not entirely all that easy, but it's social distancing, it's back wearing masks, drive people, really encourage people to get immunised wherever, at their local pharmacy, with their GP, with HSE facility, and let's all hang together on this. In KDOC, can we ask, again, parents often are in a very difficult situation with young children, and for most parents they really agonise about whether they're missing a serious illness or not. It's useful to highlight what are the serious signs. So if your child has a febrile illness and a cough, if they're having regular paracetamol, a key indicator is if they're keeping up with their fluid intake, then they're unlikely to be seriously sick, and it should be managed on a day-by-day basis. On the other hand, if their fluid intake is falling to less than half the usual amount over 24 hours, if it's really painful for them to swallow, I don't mean sore, I mean really painful, or if there's a serious hunch that something serious going on, pick up the phone and be in touch. It's very disruptive at the moment when healthcare workers get a viral respiratory tract infection. So we're here for people with cancer, for people with heart disease, for people with strokes, for people with depression. We're not keen to have non-serious viral respiratory tract infections into healthcare facilities. Some of our practices in Kildare have been very badly affected by staff members becoming acutely unwell. That means it's taking them out for 3 or 5 days at a time, and we're already, did I say, 40% short of GPs. So if we can all do the right thing ourselves, we'll be fine. We'll get through it.
Okay, on that note, spokesperson for the Kildare faculty of the ICGP, a Newbridge-based GP and indeed assistant professor for primary care at Trinity College Dublin, Brendan O'Shea. Many thanks for joining us this afternoon, Brendan, and good afternoon to you as always. Now, sticking with the same theme, we'll be covering this as well on the programme tomorrow morning on Kildare Today between 9 and 11 with Professor Gerry Killeen of University College Cork. But you may have heard this morning, Clem played some audio from Sky News, which highlights the situation in England that can be mirrored very closely to what's happening here in Ireland, and also discussing the situation in Hong Kong and some of the other countries such as China, etc., which are already starting to lock down because of some of the waves that are happening over there. Just have a listen to this piece of audio courtesy of Sky News.
The big difference is that we're now dealing with a slightly different virus. For the first few months of this year, Omicron has been dominant. It's now called BA.1, but that's now being overtaken by a very similar virus called BA.2. The two of them are so similar that they're called sister variants or sub-variants, and they are both just as sensitive to the vaccine. They both cause the same very mild disease, but the point is that BA.2 is 1.4 times more infectious, and that gives it the edge over the original Omicron virus and allows it to spread much more quickly. There has been some talk of this Deltacron variant. It's a hybrid, if you like, of two different viruses, the original Delta and Omicron, that have come together, probably in one person who's been infected with both viruses at the same time. That has been an issue in France, and at the moment there's no clear evidence that it's any more of a threat than Omicron itself. And of course, Delta was effectively dealt with by the vaccine. The situation in Hong Kong is certainly a concern, but it's very different to what we're dealing with here in the UK. In Hong Kong, vaccination rates of the elderly are much lower. It's only about 1 in 3 people over the age of 80 have actually had the vaccine. So the most vulnerable are still unprotected against the virus, which is spreading around there.
Hong Kong, disappointingly, no problem with vaccine supply. For well over a year, had not achieved coverage of our most vulnerable group.
The second point is that in Hong Kong, they use the Chinese Sinovac vaccine, and there has been a great deal of concern about just how good that is. And the Chinese are understood to be looking at mRNA vaccines, developing their own, because those have really stood out in this pandemic as the best way of protecting people against the rapidly evolving virus. Hospital admissions in the UK are also rising, and many people are concerned about that. The rise in hospital admissions aligns very precisely with the rise in cases. Both started to take off at the end of February. Now, in previous waves, you would have had a lag between people getting infected and people getting so ill that they needed emergency treatment. This time that hasn't happened. They're both happening at the same time. And that suggests the rise in hospital admissions is actually due to people coming into hospital with the virus, but opted for other conditions. They're not coming in for treatment for COVID itself. It's an important distinction. So although hospitals will be disrupted by the rise in admissions, it doesn't mean that we're going backwards. Quite firmly, the answer is no. This is a very different situation. The vaccine is still highly effective. The immunity is being topped up as the virus spreads. And the two together are in a very effective way of controlling the spread of the virus. It's very likely that as the weather warms up and we spend more time outside, that too will have an effect on transmission. But that doesn't mean Omicron has gone away. It may well return in the autumn as the effect of the boosters does begin to wear off.
Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.
Now, postmasters are to hold an emergency meeting to consider a ballot on industrial action, including to withdraw supports for changes to postal money order and foreign exchange services. The potential action comes amid mounting frustration with Unpost and government, as postmasters say morale is low and meaningful engagement is needed to resolve a range of issues. General Secretary of the Irish Postmasters Union is Ned O'Hara. Ned, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Owen. Thanks for having me on.
As I said there, there's a range of issues here that need resolving. Before we talk about some of them, just go into detail particularly about what's the situation with postal money order and foreign exchange services. What's the issue there?
I think the issue there is a tipping point for a number of issues, all small in their own right, but the one with the money orders and foreign exchange is one that has tipped, or the straw that broke the camel's back, if you like. There is a new money laundering requirement that requires people, if they want a postal order or foreign exchange for any amount, so for as little as €5 or as little as €1, you have to fill up a money laundering form which includes your name, your date of birth, and your address. Now, we're contracted and we're paid by transaction, and that results in additional work for us. And apart altogether from the additional work, which Unpost won't or aren't prepared to engage in, we just think that the issue being introduced is bureaucracy gone mad. Now, Unpost have convinced us that it's a requirement from Brussels, but it means that if you want to buy a postal order for a fiver, you go into the post office, you have to give your name and address and your date of birth. And we are meeting a lot of resistance in relation to that. Like, people are telling us to buzz off and mind their own business, that this is Big Brother gone bananas. So that's the issue, if you like, that has broken the camel's back. Mm. And the fact that Unpost won't engage on it, they just said, you have to do it, that's it. And it is incredibly frustrating for us. And it's on top of 3 or 4 other issues, again, which have been going on for over the last while, where Unpost doesn't seem to want to engage.
Let's touch on them then, Ned. So additional pay for 2021 Christmas payments is being withheld, you say. A new rate for additional agency banking services is stalled, and then pay for additional work on Western Union transactions is not forthcoming. So there are a number of small issues here, as I understand it.
There are a number of small issues, and in relation to other money laundering work that we have to do. So, like, for instance, when money laundering requires people to update their identity documents in relation to savings accounts they would have. So Unpost would write out to people and ask them to bring in 2 forms of photographic identity or 2 household bills, bring them in, we have to photocopy them and send them off. And we did agree a rate for that on Unpost early last year. It hasn't been paid yet. We were paid in 2019 and 2020 additional money. We pay double payments at Christmas. And as I said, we're paid by transaction. There's additional work involved in relation to those. We got additional money for those in 2019 and 2020, but we didn't get it for 2021. It was just withheld. Now, we think that the reason that Unpost is withholding those payments is they're looking at the bottom line. Now, every business went through a tough time in COVID, including each individual postmaster's business. And we recognise that Unpost may have bottom line issues in relation to it. They may be loss making. And we recognise that's an issue. Now, 18 months ago, Owen, we got Grant Thornton to publish a report on the state of the post office network, which said that it needed government investment. It's an asset that's owned by the state, and that it needed government investment of 15 or 17 million. In the interim, postmasters have busied themselves. They've opened longer hours. They've engaged themselves in training. They've taken on new services for Bank of Ireland and new custom services as a result of Brexit. And we have reduced the amount that's required for the government to invest from 17 million significantly. Now, I think Unpost's bottom line is suffering from that lack of investment by the government, and that may be the reason, we're surmising this, right? That may be the reason that they're not even prepared to discuss small increases in costs. The strange thing about it is we're contractors, postmasters, they're not employees, they're paid by transaction. So if we don't do the transactions, we don't get paid, and we can't understand why Unpost won't pay us for the transactions. We generate 84 or 85% of their total across the counter business. And we're not the enemy here. If we generate more business, they generate more business. And Dalvery Shin, as my maths teacher used to say, everybody is better off. But we just don't understand it. And it's mounted, or it's culminated in, we've called a members' meeting for next Monday night to see what the members want to do. We're fielding phone calls every day from postmasters who are saying, respectable people or ordinary people, whatever term you want to use, when they're asked for their date of birth, they just tell us, buzz off, it's none of our business.
And that's and resulting then in low morale among postmasters.
Low morale after COVID, the fact that the other stuff hasn't been done, the fact that we are busy and want to be busy and we do provide services, but we need to be supported as well. And I think that's the frustration. The other thing in relation to government, this time last year, as a result of the Grant Thornton report, Minister Hildegard Knocton set up an interdepartmental group to look at providing more services. We've made a submission to that and made suggestions of what new services we could do. We could do identity verification for the electoral register. So, for instance, much as we do for money laundering, if you wanted to be on the electoral register, you present yourself at the post office with your passport or your driving license or photographic ID, two bills, and you get onto the register of electors. So there is stuff we can do, but we just want government to make a decision. So the frustration comes partly to us, partly to the government. Like that report was promised to us before last July, and this is now March 2022. The report is not forthcoming. So what we are saying is, it's all those issues come together that are really, really frustrating. And as I said, we're service providers. We want to provide service in our communities. We do provide service in our communities, and we want to be allowed to continue to do that. But we've just been, there's a more impolite word than frustrated, but we really are frustrated off, if that's the term, with what's happening.
Just finally then, Ned, you touched on it there, the National Members' Meeting being called for next Monday, the March 28th, and the Irish Postmasters Union Executive has motioned discussion of a ballot on industrial action. Will it come to that? And if not, what has to be done to avoid industrial action? And also, what would industrial action mean or look like?
Well, industrial action is a last resort in any circumstances, and what we are looking for, and we want to find a solution. We're open to engage with on post, and we want to engage with on post, but we want to engage meaningfully, not the way that we have been doing. And in relation to what industrial action might look like, I don't see us closing post offices on. That's just against our grain. We just wouldn't do that because we provide vital services to people, but we may withdraw some services, or we may not. I don't want to preempt what the members will decide, right?
Right.
But like, we're conscious of the service we provide. We don't want to prevent people from accessing services, but we want to make our point at the same time.
All right, that meeting taking place next Monday, and indeed we will follow up on it and keep you updated here on KFM. But for the moment, Ned O'Hara, General Secretary with the Irish Postmasters Union. Thanks for joining us this afternoon, Ned.
Thank you very much, John.
Keep your messages coming in to us, 0833 97 97 97, text and WhatsApp. You can email studio@kfmradio.com. Midwives have voiced their concern over the fivefold increase in caesarean sections over the past 40 years. The medics who participated in a new Irish study also noted that many pregnant women were lacking knowledge and understanding that would empower them to question and engage in decision making around the birth of a child. Dr. Siobhan Corrigan is Assistant Professor in Organisational Psychology with Trinity College Dublin. She also headed up this new research, and she joins us on the line now. Siobhan, good afternoon to you and welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Owen. Thank you for having me on.
Before we talk about some of the findings here and what has kind of come from this particular report, tell us where the idea for it came and, you know, the reasons that this was carried out in the first place.
Okay, yeah, no problem. Yeah, this project, it was funded by the Irish Health Research Board, the HRB, and it commenced in 2017. The study was headed up by Professor Cecily Bagley from the School of Nursing in Midwifery. And I suppose, in light of the worldwide increase in the rate of caesarean sections, not just in Ireland, the objective of this study was to sort of really focus in on the Irish context, and in particular to explore the viewpoints of all clinicians working with pregnant women, and just for their viewpoints on this increased rate, if there was an increased rate, and then to evaluate the feasibility of introducing a sort of a number of interventions that could help reduce this rate. So that's the background.
Okay. And along with the rest of the world, Ireland is now recording a year-on-year rise in the procedure, with more than a third of babies are now born through the C-sections compared to below 1 in 10 in the 1980s. So to put that into context and into real figures, figures from 2018 show that a 37% rate in Ireland of C-sections jumped from 7% in 1984. So that puts it into context there.
Yeah.
from the research then, talking to midwives, is there reasons behind why there's such an increase in C-sections now?
Yeah, I suppose there's a number of reasons. I suppose to sort of point out right from the outset, I suppose, I mean, it's a C-section, it's a life-saving operation, you know, definitely when it's medically indicated, so it's really, really important to highlight that. But compared with vaginal birth, there is a number of factors, risk factors, for the mother and for the baby. So, but in relation to what we found, I suppose there's a number of factors we found for the reasons for the increase. So one of the strongest themes that came out of the study was that the high rates of induction of labour, so the induction rates, the early induction rates of labour have gone up quite high over the last couple of years. So that was one theme that came out quite strongly. The other theme that came out, or the other factor that came out, was knowledge. And it was felt that many midwives sort of felt that pregnant women came into maternity care not really informed completely, and lacking the knowledge and understanding that would empower them to sort of question and to challenge or engage in the decision making in and around their pregnancy and the choices for their birth. So they observed that pregnant women aren't asking for explanations of clinical indications or inquiring into different options if they're told something by an obstetrician. So that was another issue.
I could stop you there, Siobhan, and just explain something to me here, just to kind of get a feel for it. As I understand it, C-sections are kind of carried out when there is a medical problem or something is going wrong, so to speak, and it has to be done in an emergency situation. Can a woman go in and choose to have a C-section?
I mean, it appears that way, that you can go in and ask for an elective C-section, and that seems to be happening more and more. We don't have any evidence or any sort of data on that, but it does seem to be happening more and more. I mean, one of the other things that came out of our study was that maybe sort of the negative stories and that fear of natural birth. So that sort of creates, so sometimes it can erode trust in what the midwife can do. And it does push women toward the C-sections.
Again, I remember last year talking to another professor who carried out research that it's after perhaps a woman may have had one child and that was a traumatic birth, that she suffers from traumatic syndrome or something from that particular birth and doesn't want to have another natural birth after that.
Yeah, and so that's a really good point. So definitely after a very traumatic first birth or labour, maybe a lot of women then do sort of opt or prefer to go for a C-section. But they don't, the problem, I suppose, and that's fine, if it's just maybe they don't, again, it's lacking that knowledge of the sort of, you know, the risks that are involved. And again, there is this sort of myth or this misconception that if you've had a C-section on your first baby or your first birth, then you have to have a C-section on subsequent births, and that's not the case. But that fear factor is it's probably one of the most important factors, definitely. There's a whole like births.
And I know midwives as well also express concern about negative stories which circulate in the media and online that create that fear among women, which they believed could push women towards highly medicalised care pathways. Just to finish up then, Siobhan, and I mean, it's a very, very interesting study, but the key message that I got from reading through some of the data was it's all about being informed, having the knowledge, and if you're pregnant and going through that journey, to talk to midwives, talk to medical professionals, and make that decision that's right for yourself, right for your body and for your health.
Yeah, most definitely it is. And I suppose one of the outputs of this research was to include sort of additional antenatal classes where we could present evidence-based information and knowledge, you know, to the women and their partners, so that they could make that choice, because that's really, really important, is equipping them with the knowledge. So they can make the question, they can make the choice, they can make the right decisions, and they know what other options are open for them, which is really important. And for example, our midwife-led care and birthing units have been shown to show great support for women, and to sort of achieve much better normal births. There's also sort of clinics like Next Birth After Cesarean Section clinics that are run in some hospitals as well, which is really, really good, just to reassuring women. That if they have that fear, or if they've had a traumatic birth, that there is that option to have a natural vaginal birth the second time around, and the support is there.
Yeah, and I know that midwives as well believe that the rate of cesarean sections could be reduced if there was the provision of more opportunities for women to discuss their birth options with midwives. But again, it just is that advice, and you know, it can be kind of used right across the healthcare sector. If you're going in for a procedure or something like that, that you should always be knowledgeable about it, be informed and have an understanding about what's going on and what's best for yourself. But that is a very interesting study. C-sections, the fear of natural birth and negative experiences are pushing more women towards elective sections. And I can't get over that figure. 37% in 2018 compared to just 7% getting C-sections in the 1980s. And that research was headed up by the Assistant Professor in Organisational Psychology in Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Siobhan Corrigan. Very, very interesting, Siobhan. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
No problem. Thank you, Owen.
Now, Shannon Airport has introduced a new passenger security screening system at the end of last year in a €2.5 million investment. The system means that the restriction on liquids of more than 100 millilitres no longer applies, and passengers can travel with larger quantities of liquids as long as they fit into a cabin bag. Liquids, gels or creams don't have to be put into a sealed clear plastic bag. The airport said that the new system would cut the time it took to go through security in half, and I know from myself, who would be a frequent flyer, I am delighted with that news. I might be flying out of Shannon Airport more regularly now, because it was one of my pet peeves, having to get all the liquids down to 100 millilitres. If you're bringing shampoo, filling up a little small bottle and then putting it into the plastic bag. Owen Corry is a travel and aviation journalist. He's an Arklok resident and he's on the line as well. Owen, good afternoon. Welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Owen. Thanks for having me.
So Shannon Airport announcing this news, is it something that we're going to see widespread now around the country?
Yes, it's going to spread. The real issue is that it's going to be slow. We can't celebrate yet because the security system, it's a sort of a category 3, C3 security systems. They have been around for 2 or 3 years. They're expensive to install. What Shannon are doing is part of a major €17 million upgrade. They've spent €2.5 million on their security. Also, the laptop doesn't have to be taken out of the bag. People with pacemakers can go through the personal screeners. Lots of the inconveniences that you just itemized for passengers are being removed by this, but it's going to be a while for the larger airports to get it through. I do notice the UK has set a deadline of December of this year for its key airports, but it's going to take a while, and all's very well if you're flying from Shannon direct point to point, but if you're going to a transfer airport, you're running into the old problems.
Yeah, so it's worth pointing out as well, Owen, that the actual regulations haven't changed. It's just technology that's changing, and it's enabling this lifting of the rules in Shannon Airport, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. They, you know, 2006 was the day there was a plot uncovered that people were going to bring explosives on board several aircraft, disguising them as soft drinks, assemble them on board. It sent a chill down the whole security industry and the aviation industry, and they introduced this really draconian measure where no liquids more than 100 mils. People had bottles confiscated, you know, the olive oil, perfumes, things like that in their bags were taken out. It was pretty horrific experience, this particularly in the early days before passengers got used to it. We haven't seen the end of it yet, but we're getting there. And there are, like Donegal Airport has already done it. Eindhoven has done it. Two airports in Milan have done it. And I think the first large airport to do it is Copenhagen.
Okay, so good news coming out of Shannon Airport and other places around the country as well. Owen, if we just move on to some of the other issues then as well affecting the aviation industry, and I think the travel and tourism industry has been in the headlines over the last couple of years in ways that it never was before. We seem to be just recovering from the COVID pandemic, and now we have obviously the war in Ukraine with Russia's invasion. Is that having an impact as well across Europe in terms of travel?
Impact across Europe, but I do expect Europe to stay open. You know, the way COVID numbers are going, they've reached sort of record levels in a lot of countries. But what people are watching is the deaths. So obviously the vaccination rate, which is quite high in Europe, is keeping people away from what we had before, which was wholesale, you know, blunt-edged closure of travel. If you could fly from certain countries, you're not allowed in. I don't think we'll see anything like that again, because the focus moved on from the country of origin to the vaccination status. That was really the big change last July with the European COVID certificate. The rest of the world vaccination rates vary from place to place, and it's still quite iffy. So anybody travelling down the hall will still face a raft of regulations, PCR tests, for instance, for South Africa, antigen tests to get into the USA, all of those restrictions, and they are quite complex still. But within Europe, it's doing well. The war in Ukraine, it's going to impact on fuel price. That's not the biggest deal in the world if you're travelling one of the major airlines like Ryanair. And Michael O'Leary, as everyone knows, and I think I said on KFM, was a gambler by heart, and he has 80% of his fuel for the year hedged at last year's rate. So it'll take a while for those price increases to shift through. But there's no doubt the Ukraine war is playing havoc with us in terms of our life, our prices at the pumps and our prices at electricity. And hoteliers and restaurateurs all over Europe are facing the same issues. Prices are going to rise as a result of that.
Yeah, more than 40 countries, including the EU and the US, have closed airspace to Russian airlines, and Russia has in turn banned airlines from those countries from flying over Russia. International air passengers between Russia and Europe accounted for 5.7% of total European traffic in 2021, and all routes between Europe and Russia have been cancelled. Owen, just before we let you go, because I know you're very busy, I heard you on national media earlier this morning talking about that devastating issue and incident over in China where the plane crashed. Have you any more information on that, or just a bit of background info on what happened?
Yeah, there won't be information on, even though there's a lot of speculation. There could be 20 or 30 reasons behind that. But it's a huge human tragedy, but also an industry tragedy. The main point really is that the Boeing MAX, which was very much in the headline, this was not a Boeing MAX, it was a Boeing 737. It's by far the most popular aircraft in the sky. It's the workhorse of major airlines, including Ryanair. And it's quite unusual, because we were back in 2016, 2017, in a situation where there was no major or only one major commercial aircraft crash. There was one year with none at all. The Boeing MAX changed that, and it sent a great deal of fear that what's behind this. Is it a mechanical failure? Is there something that happened we should know more about? The flight path of the aircraft is quite interesting. It dropped very suddenly, about 20,000 feet, and then seemed to recover height and then dropped again. But by the time it was dropping, it was travelling at supersonic speed. So, you know, while people are saying the whole door might have broken open, the tail came off, winglets came off, they were all debris found at different places. Mm-hmm. But the speed at which it fell to earth were way beyond the design capabilities of the aircraft. So questions will be asked: did it start breaking up before it fell, or was that caused by the fall? I think we'll be, you know, gathering information for a long time on this, but it does look like some sort of mechanical failure before we come to the spicier theories that you find on the internet about somebody trying to get into the cockpit or pilot suicide, as happened at Germanwings. There's lots of mechanical reasons why this could have happened. It'll be a while before we know.
Yeah, and as you said there, it is a human tragedy with that plane crash over in China. That is Owen Curry, travel and aviation journalist, RClock resident, on a range of aviation issues there. Shannon Airport scrapping the 100 milliliter liquid restriction, travel being affected due to the Ukrainian invasion, and as we mentioned there, that terrible, terrible crash over in China. That just about wraps up the programme for this afternoon. We'll be back again tomorrow between 2 and 3 for more of the same. I'll join you in the morning with Clem between 9 and 11 on the Kildare Today programme, and Ben Atkinson is up next after the news at 3 with K-Drive Classic Gold.
Kildare Focus with Owen Beattie.